Two men in eastern Montana have died due to West Nile virus. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us how the Montana Developmental Center is dealing with budget cuts. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry explains a disagreement over the management of non-native lake trout in Flathead Lake. And in tonight's feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with the co-chair of the Montana Partnership to End Childhood Hunger. State health officials say two men from eastern Montana have died after contracting West Nile virus. The Department of Public Health and Human Services says a man in his 80s died in Treasure County, while a man in his 70s died in Yellowstone County. An obituary in the Billings Gazette said 79-year-old Clyde Stanhope of Billings died Sunday of West Nile virus. State officials say 15 cases of West Nile have been reported since early this month, including the two deaths. Most people exposed to the mosquito-transmitted virus experience no symptoms. Some develop a mild illness, while fewer than 1 in 150 may become severely infected with encephalitis or meningitis.
And in other news from around the state, mass shootings such as the recent Washington Navy Yard killings have prompted Montana lawmakers to look at whether the state should turn over mental illness histories for federal background checks of gun purchases. Deputy Attorney General John Bennion told a legislative panel today that his agency has fielded calls from the public and lawmakers about how Montana handles the mentally ill and background checks. The state has confidentiality laws that prohibit it from turning over records for federal background checks of anybody committed to a mental institution or judged to meet the federal definition of mentally defective. Advocates from the National Alliance on Mental Illness and the American Civil Liberties Union say a person who has been successfully treated for mental illness should be able to possess a gun.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has approved two nominees for federal judgeships in Montana. The nominations of Yellowstone County District Judge Susan Waters and Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris now move to the full U.S. Senate for confirmation. Senator Max Baucus recommended Waters to replace former U.S. District Judge Richard Siebel in Billings and Morris to replace senior U.S. District Judge Sam Haddon in Great Falls. The committee interviewed Waters and Morris in July. The Billings Gazette reports their nominations were approved today. Waters has been a judge in Montana's 13th Judicial District since 1998, when she was appointed by former Governor Mark Roscoe. Morris has been a Supreme Court Justice since 2005.
The Montana Developmental Center in Boulder is going through some major changes in order to comply with budget cuts handed down by the state legislature. The faculty provides treatment to people with developmental disabilities whose aggressive behavior has led the courts to determine they pose a risk to themselves or others. Those in charge at MDC say they need to trim out about 10% from their budget without compromising safety or their standard of care.
Rags, towels, robes, you name it, anything.
24-year-old Cody is moving a load of whites over from the washing machine to the dryer.
Push a button so I can set the temperature.
Doing laundry is Cody's job at the Montana Developmental Center.
And there's a little button in the middle that you can start it with.
He's one of about 50 people committed here by the state. MDC calls these people clients. Cody gets paid to do this work. Well, not right now.
Right now we're on furlough because we're reorganizing the work program, and because of the cuts, we had to stop it.
Pauli Peterson is the clinical director at MDC. She says the legislature cut about $1.5 million from the facility's annual budget. To meet these cuts, the facility shut down one of its six residential units, doubling up some clients in other rooms. Jobs have been cut, some vacancies are not being filled, and client payroll. MDC is cutting 80% of the budget for vocational services. Peterson says clients have become accustomed to getting paid a few dollars an hour for doing a lot of things, essentially basic household chores.
If they went out and swept the sidewalk for an hour, then they could go in and write it down and they would get paid for that.
Largely, that's all over now. MDC Superintendent Jean Hare says they are re-examining what role having a job plays in the client's treatment.
So we're looking at each person and specifically what kind of vocational services would help therapeutically to address the reasons that they came here.
Now, clients will be taking vocational training courses. If they pass through these courses, they can apply to be hired for a select number of jobs on the site where they will get paid again. Jobs like doing the laundry.
We are very disappointed that they chose Rather than to curb administrative costs, they chose to cut the vocational services.
Helena Democratic State Senator Mary Cafaro works for a nonprofit that promotes the rights of the developmentally disabled. She thinks MDC could have found another place to cut the $40,000 they cut for client pay. Cafaro fought in the legislature this year to shut the facility down completely.
I believe that the institution has to go.
She believes the clients could receive more dignified and appropriate care in community treatment centers at a much lower cost to the state per client. Cafaro says the average cost per person in community treatment?
$37,000 a year.
$37,000. The average cost per client at MDC? More than $250,000 per year. A $14 million total budget this year to treat 50 people.
MDC is a very small but expensive piece of the big picture.
But MDC staff argue it's a very important piece. Clinical Director Polly Peterson stops outside the closed door of a classroom on the grounds. Inside, a group of male clients is talking.
That was our sex offenders treatment program.
The men hash out their feelings with a therapist.
We help the clients to understand what happened when they committed a sexual offense, both in terms of their impulses and also the effect that their crime had or their offense had on the victims.
Six of the clients at MDC have criminal convictions, such as rape and sexual abuse of children. But courts decided the Montana State Prison was not suited for them because of their mental disabilities. Superintendent Jean Hare says walking around a controlled environment like MDC, most of the clients seem calm and happy, and most of the time they are.
Just because that's what you observe in the moment doesn't mean that the full stability and the full assistance that they need and providing them with the tools that they need to then go back out into a community setting have had a chance to, you know, be fully effective.
He says everybody committed to MDC has been placed there because of a potential for harming themselves or others. Some are outright violent. Harris says MDC is equipped to handle these cases in a way community treatment centers are not. Both Jean Hare and Clinical Director Polly Peterson were brought on to head MDC a couple of years ago after the facility made headlines for accusations of client abuse by staff. Harris says they are trying to change the image and alter the mission of MDC. It used to be that clients might stay at the facility for many years, in some cases decades. Harris says he wants to work toward MDC being a short-term care facility to move clients back into a community setting within a year if possible, if it's safe. But there is still worry. MDC is managed by the Department of Public Health and Human Services, and Director Richard Opper hopes cuts to the program will not become a regular occurrence.
When you really reduce the budget to the point where we won't be able to protect the health and safety of these individuals, then you don't have a viable facility.
Much of the money cut from MDC this time around did go toward rate increases for community treatment providers. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The Flathead Lake fishery has cultural, ecological, and economic significance for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes on the south end of the lake and for the non-tribal land around the north end. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the tribes have been co-managing the lake, but disagree over the best way to discourage non-native lake trout dominance over native trout. The tribes recently approved a more aggressive method of controlling lake trout in the lake. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on why the tribes feel it is warranted and where the state stands.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have approved the most aggressive alternative for lake trout suppression identified in their draft environmental impact statement. This alternative allows for reducing the lake trout population by up to 75%. Manager for the CSKT Division of Fish, Wildlife, Recreation, and Conservation, Tom McDonald, says that's a maximum, and this option allows for the most flexibility in management. The tribes say the goal is to increase the number of threatened bull trout and other native fish like West Slope cutthroat trout. If more aggressive options, including netting, resulted in harvest of these native fish, they would stop. McDonald says the tribes have a cultural and moral connection, as well as a national policy, to see the bull trout population trend increase.
Incredibly important for the people of the Salish and Kootenai Nation to be able to protect and make sure under their watch that this animal that's been part of sustaining them for tens of thousands of years remains resilient on this landscape, to allow them to become extinct is culturally wrong.
The tribes and the state entered into a Flathead Lake and River co-management plan in 2000. This plan identifies certain goals, including bull trout population numbers. McDonald says it okays the use of more aggressive management tools if they're not hitting targeted numbers. He says this is happening despite the popular MAC Days contests in the spring and fall, which encourage angling pressure through a tournament and has been bringing in more than half of the 70,000 lake trout harvested on Flathead Lake annually. The tribes say it's time to increase the pressure on the lake trout.
Unfortunately, we do not agree at this point.
Regional Fisheries Manager Jim Vashra with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says the co-management plan identifies what's called secure levels of bull trout, and the population numbers are still 50% above those levels.
We would like to see for a few more years to see how the current management plays out, if it really helps out cutthroat and bull trout in any way.
Vashro says there are several other suppression efforts ongoing throughout the West, and they aren't yet seeing benefits to native fish. He says the state agrees with the tribes in wanting to see better bull trout numbers, but is concerned that more aggressive measures will destabilize the population and make bull trout numbers drop even lower.
The other problem is that lake trout are the primary sport fishery left in Flathead Lake, and if doing this is going to reduce that sport fishing potential a great deal. You want to be sure that you're going to get some benefits to native fish in return for that. And we think there's a lot of uncertainty on what these proposals hold.
McDonald says MAC Days has been very successful, but it started more than a decade ago, and he says it's not enough.
We spent the last 12 years working on this, and unfortunately, we haven't seen the results from our effort. So it didn't make any sense to continue doing MAC Days if we're not reducing the lake trout population. It's a form of craziness if we would keep spending our money and not get our response that we're trying to work for.
The tribes will continue holding MAC Days with the fall competition starting up the first Friday of October. The alternative chosen continues to use angling pressure and brings in options like trap netting, gill netting, commercial fishing, and bounties to meet a maximum reduction goal of 75% of the lake trout population. The co-management plan has expired, but Vashro says they continue to operate along the principles of the plan.
The state and tribe do have a different perspective on the resource, and we appreciate that from both sides. What we're trying to do is see whether there's some common ground that we can both move forward together on. We were able to get there 13 years ago. Maybe we can do it again.
Vashra says the state's action if the tribes go ahead with more aggressive management options remains to be seen. The reservation surrounds the south end of the lake. However, the north end is still the same lake, and the tribes say legal precedent backs up their ability to access and manage a shared resource, even off the reservation. The tribes are working on the final environmental assessment, which includes comments from the public and the state. It goes before the Bureau of Indian Affairs for final approval, and the plan could take effect by 2014. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Simon O'Dwyer and Maria Cullen O'Dwyer are from North Galway in Ireland. The couple is in Montana this week and will be presenting a lecture entitled 3,000 Years of Ancient Ireland's Music and Instruments. For more than 20 years, they have been studying and playing the prehistoric music creations. Simon O'Dwyer says late Bronze Age horns and authentic replicas of early instruments are used in exploring their ancient culture.
Well, I suppose for us the real ambition is to bring instruments that are 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 years old back to life, and to get them played again in the living tradition, because that's a direct connection over thousands of years, and that gives us a feel for our ancestry and our past and where we belong.
The first President's Lecture Series presentation of the fall will be this evening at the Denison Theater on the UM Missoula campus. The lecture and demonstration begins at 8 p.m. and is free and open to the public. The O'Dwyers will also offer this lecture in Butte tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. at the Butte Silver Bow Public Archives. We have an extended interview and an ancient horn demonstration on the Montana Public Radio website. Further information is available online at friendsofirishstudies.com.
One in five Montana kids is going hungry. People who want to change that sobering statistic are gathering in Bozeman next week for a statewide summit on how to end childhood hunger. The summit will take place September 23rd and 24th at Montana State University. Minky Medora is co-chair of the Montana Partnership to End Childhood Hunger. In this feature interview, Medora talks with News Director Sally Mock about the 145,000 Montanans who are food insecure and the 20% of Montana kids who struggle with hunger.
That number is really not reflective of many more children who are at risk of hunger, because the 1 in 5 number comes from the children who are living in poverty. And while poverty is one measure, it's not the only measure because it's 100%, when national studies year after year have shown, and the latest report just came out from USDA, until a family's income reaches 185% of poverty, they are not food secure. And so based on that, there are almost 90,000 children in Montana at risk of hunger. These numbers seem incredible, but they are a reality when you talk to people who work in childcare centers and schools and daycares and food banks especially. Food banks have seen an enormous rise.
And one statistic says there was a 50% increase in children visiting Montana food banks between 2009 and 2011, quite recently.
Yes, that is correct. In fact, in 2012, when we had nearly 1.15 million visits to the food bank. Now, these are visits. That means the same person can come repeatedly. But in that number, 300,000 were children. So it's pretty significant.
But even more startling, I think, is that there are many families and children in Montana who don't participate in available food benefit programs, don't go to food banks, don't take advantage of school lunch programs,
right.
Don't take advantage of federal food payments and so on.
That's right. And this is one of the things the Montana Partnership to End Childhood Hunger is trying very hard to increase awareness and outreach of these programs. And mind you, the programs themselves have been doing it and doing a very good job, but we need to help them get the word out. When you think about the program SNAP, which was formerly the food stamp program, more than 41% of the clients in SNAP are children. And we only think of SNAP in terms of adults and seniors. But these are families with children, and that's the single largest feeding program in the country. But in addition, we have wonderful programs like the school meals, the school lunch program, the school breakfast program, the after-school snacks program. We also have the very good WIC program that deals with women and pregnant women and children, that provides food vouchers and nutrition education. We have the child and adult care food programs that provide reimbursement to child care centers that have low-income families.
So all these great programs, but as we just said, people not participating, and the reasons for that are many. One is stigma.
One is stigma. Now, we do studies every other year through the Montana Food Bank Network of Hungry in Montana, and we find that stigma is, in our study anyway, more of a problem with seniors and adults than with families and children. But yes, it is an issue.
And another issue is transportation. Many of Montanans live in remote places.
Exactly.
On reservations, for example.
Yes.
Don't even have transportation sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because really one big factor in child hunger and hunger in general is lack of transportation and distances to any kind of service, including emergency food pantries. But people in remote rural areas of the state We know of families that will drive between 60 to 70 miles one way to get to a retail grocery store. Their other option is to go to the local convenience store and buy food that costs more. There's very poor quality in many cases and variety, and I think many smaller stores are trying to improve on it, but it's harder for them to stock more variety. So is it, should I pay for gas to drive 40 to 50 or 70 miles, or shall I just shop here? One way or the other, it costs the family. And this is a very, I mean, we have what is known as food deserts in the state.
And then another obstacle is the paperwork involved in some of these programs is daunting.
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's a difficult thing because our public assistance programs, they provide tremendous benefits, but they are guided by federal regulations that require a certain amount of paperwork. And so that does cause, that is daunting. In addition, sometimes people can't get to the office in time to apply because it's only open during the same hours they're working. Some places are trying to provide services on weekends. There are many people who think there must be somebody else who needs it more than me, so I better not apply. Or they think, I'll manage, I'll figure it out. But it just doesn't happen.
Knowing all this, Minky, it seems like the steps to help remove these obstacles are somewhat clear, aren't they? Better transportation, help with people with the paperwork, education about what's available, etc. Are they obvious?
Yes, they truly are. What we're trying to do is bring that information out. For example, transportation goes beyond what just the Partnership to End Childhood Hunger can do. This needs to be a statewide discussion. This needs to be a discussion at the legislature.
Because there's some money involved.
Yes, of course there's money involved, but there are states that have done innovative things to bring food to rural areas. There are some companies that will open a small grocery store, but still a full retail scale one in smaller areas. In parts of the country, they have started mobile food trucks that requires a little bit more planning and what the people want. But it can be delivered that way. So those things are happening. And most of all, if there was some way that we could provide incentives to small rural grocery stores to, and, you know, provide them a tax benefit or some kind of incentive to expand their services, provide refrigeration for fresh fruits and vegetables, look at prices, a lot of this could be overcome.
And that's in part why you're having this summit in Bozeman, is to brainstorm these ideas and also network to move this forward. And you actually have this 10-step plan with deadlines that you're meeting to overcome this, because the goal is to end childhood hunger in Montana, not alleviate it.
And that's correct. And it is a very lofty goal to say we will end childhood hunger, but it is possible. And the reason that our 10-step plan has benchmarks is that we are measuring how we're doing. And these were started in 2010. So we're in the third year now. At this point, we've made the first five-year plan, and then we will expand to the next five, looking at what our measures are. Not everything will work perfectly, but our point is, let's find out where the barriers and limitations are. Let's find out which parts of the state there are issues that we can help overcome, because it's not one size fits all. And part the exciting thing about our summit is that we want to create awareness of the issue. We want to bring in a variety of people into this. We want to explain the 10 steps, but also share some best practices that are going on around the state. And most of all, we want people to understand, why do we even care? Does it matter that children are hungry? Well, of course, nobody wants to see a hungry child. But it is important for their physical development in childhood, in infancy, all the way through. It's important for their academic performance, which is clearly, and research has shown this repeatedly, affects their ability to study, affects their social and emotional behavior in school, and their success in graduation. And the one point that we most want to get out to the public is, think about these children as our future. They are our future adults. We need the business community, the employers, to pay attention to this and to be involved in this. And so we urge people of all backgrounds to attend this summit and see what they can do, because there is something for everyone. It's not just the people who do the food programs. It's the entire community. And so our hope is that we can get a diverse population.
Well, I have been speaking with Minky Medora, who's co-chair of the Montana Partnership to End Childhood Hunger, and the Summit to End Childhood Hunger will take place in Bozeman September 23rd and 24th. Minky, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Sally.
Now for tonight's weather forecast. Across our listening area, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs in the 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Dr. Tom Roberts.
About 60% of non-elderly people get health insurance through their employer. There are other ways. Some young adults are now insured through their parents' policies up to the age of 26. As a result of the Affordable Care Act. Of course, if you happen to be 65 or older, Medicare kicks in. There are still some things to think about with Medicare, but whether or not you have health insurance is not the concern. Children, pregnant women, and those with disabilities can often qualify for Medicaid. We as a state, and in fact most states, recognize that it makes sense to invest money in Medicaid coverage for these folks. Keeping mothers healthy saves money in the long run by preventing adverse outcomes like premature babies. Keeping kids healthy prevents later problems, and those with severe disabilities simply have nowhere else to go. But if you're paying attention, you know that adults don't get insurance through their job or often without insurance at all. These may be unemployed people, but most are working for an employer who doesn't offer coverage. These people without employer-based insurance until now have had very few choices. Employer-based insurance is mostly a historical accident. During World War II, in order to attract and keep workers, employers started adding benefits. The federal government cooperated by making employer-financed health insurance tax-deductible. Part of the expense of running a business is apparently to keep employees healthy. This has been the standard for the past 70 years, but doing it this way leaves many people in bad situations. As the cost has steadily risen, many employers have been forced to either drop insurance completely or to provide health insurance that has major limitations. Putting more of the economic burden on the employees through higher deductibles is one way to buy cheaper insurance. Another way is to provide insurance with major limits on spending. Buying policies with a $60,000 limit, for example, will be cheaper and provide enough coverage for many employees. But for the one who develops cancer, this amount doesn't begin to take care of the cost of treatment. This is called underinsurance, and it has become increasingly common. Meanwhile, the unemployed and those who don't have health insurance through their work may have tried to look for it on the open market. What they find is that this kind of individual insurance is very expensive and has high out-of-pocket spending if they can find it at all. Many people with a history of illness are now excluded from buying any health insurance because of these pre-existing conditions. And the money used to buy this insurance is taxed. Getting health care is not tax deductible if it's not a business expense. In Montana, many small groups have banded together to form associations. These groups have acted like a large employer. Because the cost of insuring a large group of working people is spread out between the healthy and the not-so-healthy, and there is some pooling of administrative costs, large employers and associations have been able to buy insurance more cheaply than small groups and individuals. The insurance companies face less risk in insuring a large group. In fact, many of these groups actually self-insure, which means that the insurance companies only process the claims. The actual risk is assumed by the larger group itself. With the new health insurance exchanges, now called marketplaces, much of this is about to change. Individuals will soon be able to go online and buy affordable insurance which is not linked to their jobs. Prior health problems will not raise costs. There will be no limit to actual spending if people develop serious problems. Those with lower incomes will get financial assistance to purchase the insurance, and in many cases this help will be very significant. As the actual rates have come in, we have seen that the cost of buying policies for small groups will be more than if those same people go to the individual marketplace. In other words, the need for workplace-based health insurance for small groups is going away. And people will not need to stay with their same job just to make sure that they can obtain health insurance for themselves and their family. Small employers, especially those with low-paid workers, will soon be out of the business of providing health insurance. For some small groups with high earners, it may continue to make sense to buy insurance to avoid paying taxes on that money. Business-based health insurance costs will still be tax-deductible, at least for now. Large groups will be required to continue to provide health insurance for their employees or pay a small fine, though this penalty will not be changed in 2014. Although we expect to see some issues with implementation, right now it looks like this whole thing is going to work. There will certainly be big changes. But given the alternative of staying with our current dysfunctional system, it looks like this new approach is moving us in the right direction. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Tom Roberts.
Dr. Tom Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Connor tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.